It's time for TWiT this week in tech. There's lots to talk about. We've got a great panel to do it. Dan Gilmore from the Cronkite School at Arizona State. We've got Stephen Kovac from Tech Insider and our own Denise Howell from This Week in Law. Denise will weigh in on the Google versus Oracle case going on right now. We've got a preview of Google I.O. coming up this week. And what happened to Bodie McBoatface? We've got the answer all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 562, recorded Sunday, May 15th, 2016. Mommy, where'd the clock go? This Week in Tech is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twit and using the promo code TWIT. And by Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com/twit and get $5 off your first order. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code TWIT for 30% off your entire order. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the week's tech news. It's going to be a big week ahead, and we've got a great panel to discuss it the week behind and the week ahead, starting with Steve Kovac joining us from what used to be a Business Insider. Now it's the special Tech Insider publication within Business Insider, techinsider.io. Steve, great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Techinsider.io. Is it fair to say that that is inside Business Insider?
It's the first spinoff site that the company has done, so it's a totally separate publication.
So it's really outside Business Insider.
It's outside, but I still work in the same newsroom as all the other Business Insider folks, so it's same company.
Basically. I love this. Why Minecraft is so incredible, and there's a picture of a battleship in a harbor.
Yeah, people do crazy stuff in Minecraft.
Oh, they do. It's so much fun. I should show you. Somebody, I'll show you the TWIT Minecraft build.
Oh, nice.
We have, it's a whole gorgeous city, and there are ships in the harbor and all sorts of stuff. I've become a Minecraft fanatic, and now we started playing it in VR, and it's really fun.
MineCon is in California this year?
Is it?
Yeah.
Your son probably told you that.
My son wanted very badly to
go. I bet he did.
But the tickets, they sold them in two batches of 6,000. Each batch went in a minute.
What?
Wow. Yeah.
That's, by the way, Denise Howell, of course, from This Week in Law. Always a thrill to have Denise on TWIT. And you can see her every week, every Thursday on it's Thursday or Friday.
Friday,
sorry.
Friday, 11 a.m.
I know it's on my day off because I listen. I sit in my jammies and I listen. I listen to This Week in Law. There's some law to talk about. Big, big case going on, Google versus Oracle. It's back in court, and we're starting to hear arguments, and it's kind of mind-boggling. Also joining us, I'm thrilled to have a guy who hasn't been on TWIT in quite some time, but a man I've always admired, going back to the 90s when he was a Silicon Valley reporter for the San Jose Mercury News and one of the, you know, the best journalists in technology. He's now at the Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University and also writes for a number of publications. Dan Gilmore, great to have you back on TWIT.
It's great to be back.
Thanks for joining us. I want to start, you wrote an article actually, Dan, that I think we can use to kick off on your column on Slate, your Future Tense column, why it's so funny Republicans are upset with Facebook for censoring news. First of all, I think there is a certain amount of, I don't believe this story coming from these anonymous curators that were brought in to work at Facebook. I mean, last week, the same anonymous people or person said, oh, yeah, Facebook was just using us to polish their algorithm and blah, blah, blah. Now they're saying Facebook actually censored conservative news. Do you believe that's true, Dan?
Well, I think first or second paragraph, I did not write that headline. I said
that's a good headline.
we should be really cautious about believing this because it's based on anonymous sources. But
and by the way, as you point out, from Gawker Media, which makes it even less reasonable to trust.
Right, another interesting thing.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of doubts to start, but the thing about it that's really intriguing to me is that Republicans, even if this is not true, there's a really good and interesting point there, which is that Facebook has unprecedented control over what news is at this point. And it's charming to watch Republicans suddenly realize that a big company has a lot of power. But they should have realized that a long time ago, and that if I were in charge of any policy right now, I would have the antitrust people looking incredibly hard at Facebook because what the power they're getting is, again, unprecedented and I think dangerous.
It would be a kind of a bitter irony if a party that championed the free market was bit by a company that used the free market to dominate news. And it is true, I think, that – and I know one of the things you teach at Arizona State at the Cronkite School is media literacy. It is true, is it not, that Facebook is the source of news for a vast majority of Americans, like the primary source.
Yeah, it's dangerous that there's one company with this kind of power.
Is it more dangerous that it's – I mean, doesn't Google have similar power?
I think Google should be under intense scrutiny all the time because of the power that they have in search.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're under sufficient amount of scrutiny at this point, although Europe is doing a lot at the same time. What they're doing is kind of weird, so it's that's a problem. But
that seems to be more about Android than it does about control of
I can't quite figure out what Europe thinks it's doing with this. Right. But we really have to start acknowledging as a society that Silicon Valley companies are, or tech writ large, has enormous influence that is not something that we've thought too much about beyond, well, look at what they can do, and they have the power to shut down speech. The First Amendment, if you use Facebook, is not relevant. It's the terms of service that are relevant.
Right. Denise, I'm curious whether you think, A, that Facebook is slanting the news. It would behoove them to be as careful as they can to look balanced.
Yeah, I've got to confess that until this story came around, I never looked at the trending topics over on the right. I didn't even know it was there.
Well, that's easy. That's easy because there's so much crap on the Facebook page.
Right.
You know, Facebook groups. What? They have groups? Oh, yeah, it's right here on the left. Well, who knew? So I understand that.
I wonder if I'm alone in that or not. I'm sure there are many people who religiously go to it for their news. I just am not one of those people, and I imagine I'm not alone in that regard. Where I get my news via Facebook, and I think it's important to recognize we're talking about Facebook as a source of news, but all they're really doing is pointing you to other sources.
Right.
Based on whatever their editors are putting in the trending topics. And based on what each individual editor is putting in their feed. And that's where I get my news. I get my news from the people that I follow on Facebook. And yes, that leads to, I realize that leads to an echo chamber. And I see a certain kind of news based on the kinds of people I follow. But that's not Facebook's responsibility. I do think it's good that this was brought to Facebook's attention. I don't know if they were conscious that this was happening. And I, you know, if you read what Zuckerberg has to say, he's anxious to make sure that over there in that right-hand trending topics column that they have an even-handed editorial approach to what they're presenting.
Well, but there's also the algorithm, right? So what you see on Facebook, and I think most normal people have no idea of this, is very carefully modified by computer algorithm. You don't see everything that Aunt Judy posts. You don't see everything that your friend posts. You may see more of something that somebody you don't know posts, but you follow. And that's where I think is. Do you think, Dan, that's the case, that that's where Facebook could advertently or inadvertently very much influence what people see?
Well, when we say that an algorithm is making decisions, we're one step or several steps removed from the actual decision maker, which is the programmer who wrote the algorithm.
Right.
And so there are editors at every level of how Facebook does news, whether it's in your feed or in the trending area. And among those editors is the user. But there's a complete lack of transparency about what actually goes on. And that's, you know, Facebook's as well. You know, we don't show our algorithms, as Google says the same thing. And so we're basically relying on a company that is without precedent in its size and reach, making decisions that are editorial decisions, whether they're made by a programmer or an editor. And I'm actually glad to see they're using both. But we have this fundamental issue of not knowing exactly what is going on. I will say one thing about their they did put out, after The Guardian published part of it, pretty much their full guidelines for their human editors. There's some redactions as for how governmental they're. But I thought it was interesting because it showed to me that they've actually put a lot more thought into this, what aggregation, et cetera, means than almost any news organization you can name.
This is also a time when Facebook is actively courting the news media to put content on Facebook using instant articles. And now with Facebook Live Video, at least a few outlets, not the big networks, but at least a few outlets are starting to do Facebook Live video. I know the Activision folks are going to do a daily live video to push esports. Everybody's jumping on this bandwagon because Facebook is the one place you can go on the internet where you know almost everybody's going to see it, or at least there's a chance for everybody to see it. We don't know exactly how well that part works.
And you're just describing, again, you're describing another element of Facebook's power over the news. If news organizations feel absolutely no alternative but to be part of that, I think that's amazingly short-sighted of news organizations to basically pour their futures into a company that, in the end, is their biggest competitor for advertising.
Right.
But, you know, when has the news industry ever thought past, you know, next week? I don't remember that ever happening. So, again, I'm glad to see people starting to think and talk about that. Emily Bell, who teaches at Columbia University, did a wonderful piece called Facebook is Eating the News or Eating the Internet. And I think we really have to, I don't mean to be a broken record on this, but I desperately want people to pay attention to this and other re-centralizing factors that are taking the power that we had as individuals and putting it back in the center instead of at the edges where we are.
Boy, was that a brief. That was a brief moment in time where news was democratized and everybody had a voice. And then never mind. And the problem is you see something like Facebook that does wield such potential power. This is what I fear, Dan, when you say we need to keep an eye on this, is that everybody is a stakeholder and everybody's going to want to suborn Facebook to do what they want to do. The government's going to do that. The Republicans are going to want to do that. The Democrats are going to want to do that. And everybody's going to get as active as they can. But unfortunately, it's not going to be to protect us, the people. It's going to be to use Facebook as best they can against us. Let me ask Steve, you know, do you guys, either Business Insider or Tech Insider, you must look at Facebook and there must be meetings saying, well, should we post our content on Facebook? Should we use instant articles? What do we do?
All the time. And I mean, first of all, what really bothers me is maybe it was about a year ago, Facebook told Recode that trending topic section was completely by algorithm. And then it comes out a couple weeks ago, which is a lie. It was actually a lie. So first of all, they're lying about how this product works.
That's a bad sign.
And, you know, and like Dan was just saying, they have all this power over the content we see, and they're lying about how that content gets to you. So that's my first big problem. And then it comes out, we do have these editors, and by the way, here are guidelines, and they're humans and so forth. Whether or not there's editors are censoring, that's almost besides the point right now. I mean, just the fact that they're lying about how this product works. At the same time, I don't think the trending module matters that much because it exists mostly in the desktop version. Most people use Facebook on mobile, and that trending thing is just buried in the app. You never see it. The algorithm in the newsfeed is built to keep you addicted and scrolling through as much as possible. So it's going to give you stuff it thinks you like. If you're a liberal, you're going to get a lot of Democratic liberal news. I get a lot of – that's what my feed looks like. It looks like a lot of Business Insider, a lot of Tech Insider, a lot of WSJ and New York Times articles. I don't get a lot of, you know, Breitbart and things like that in my feed just because Facebook over time has learned the content I'm going to want to see and want to keep scrolling through. So that's another part. There is a built-in bias into the algorithm, which is to keep the individual happy and scrolling through. So
that's in their long-run business interest, right. is exactly. Getting you to use more Facebook, news.
Right. And then as for media companies like Business Insider and Tech Insider, of course, every new media company or old media company, The Times is doing it too, is constantly talking about, I mean, we're shifting our strategy, you know, year by year based on what Facebook thinks is hot. A year ago or a year and a half ago, they went all in on video. So we started pumping out tons of video natively to Facebook. Then it's instant articles. That's been kind of lukewarm so far. And now it's all about Facebook Live, where they're literally paying media companies, not Business Insider yet, but that might be happening. They're literally paying media companies to post live video, and you get a bunch of garbage. You get a Washington Post columnist eating his own column. You get, an exploding watermelon. That's not journalism. It just stunts. So I think we really have to kind of take a step back when we talk about, as journalists, the kind of stuff we're posting to Facebook. And whether or not that's useful to the viewership or if it's just to get eyeballs for fun. And that's something we're constantly talking about at BI and TI.
Well, that video of Dana Milbank eating his column was good video. I mean, that was worth seeing. He had predicted that Donald Trump would not get the Republican nomination and said, I will eat my column if he does. And he did.
Yeah, but it was a stunt. It was a joke.
It's a stunt. It's not news.
I think some Canadian publication, they're eating cheese. Mike.com, they tied helium balloons to a dollhouse to see if it could fly up. What are we watching?
But that's why Facebook probably wants to put more real news in there. Why they're working so hard to put more substance in your feed, right?
But that's the result of these media partnerships. That's the result of Facebook paying Mike to put this content in your feed. So Facebook wants to put more news in your feed, but you get people eating cheese.
Right.
It's not working right now.
So I did an interesting experiment on Facebook. I followed all the candidates for president, Republican, Democrat, even Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, one of the Libertarian candidates. And I'm still getting mostly dogs playing with lemons.
I have a good solution for you, Leah.
What's that?
I have a good friend, she's one of my best friends, and she is as politically opposite from me as she could be.
Oh, follow her.
Follow your best friend who is completely the other end of the political spectrum and put them in your close friends category, and then you'll see all their stuff.
But aren't most people going to do the exact opposite, which is unfriend, unfollow, and concentrate the stuff on stuff they want to see. See, I don't think people, even though they admit they're getting their news from Facebook, they don't see it as a news source. That's the real risk of Facebook, is that we are getting all of this material kind of unconsciously.
Right. I saw some study come across my Twitter feed, and of course, I didn't click it. I just read the headline. But
that's the other problem, by the way.
But the stat was right there in the headline, and it was a significant portion of people don't know where the news is coming from. Like if they see it, whether it's a Business Insider article, a Slate article,
no, we don't
they
know.
Just see it as Facebook. It's Facebook is pushing this content to me. I don't know where it comes from. I'm just like scrolling through Facebook. And so that's a problem too. There's no brand identity. If you're a new publication like Tech Insider is not even a year old yet, and we're trying to build a brand identity and relying on Facebook to do that, it's kind of tough because people don't realize, or a lot of people don't realize, those articles are coming from Tech Insider or New York Times or wherever. They just, it's Facebook, and that's great for Facebook, not so great for the media companies.
So why do the media companies keep pouring all their stuff into Facebook?
They're desperate.
The unfortunate truth is we need viewership, and right now Facebook controls all of that. And the unfortunate thing is, you kind of have to bend to what's hot on Facebook at the time. And I know that's maybe not the best long term, but it's what you need right now to grow. It's the new media landscape is intensely competitive. And we're seeing the littler guys, die off and consolidate. But even among the big guys, you got to bend to what Facebook's doing.
Facebook's a media company, right? I mean, do we agree now? It's not a social network. That's the old days. It's a media company.
They don't see themselves as a media company.
No, they don't.
Well, they're a little of everything, but to the extent that people are creating media using Facebook, of course they're a media company. They're certainly a media company because they're selling advertising. That's what media companies generally do. And so thereby, some standards, the second biggest media company in the world after Google.
I have a question for Dan before we leave this topic, if that's okay, Leo.
Yeah, of course, please.
Dan, I'm wondering, you're talking about wanting to keep a close eye on Google from the search standpoint to make sure that when people get results that they're getting what's relevant and things aren't getting filtered out. And that perhaps we should be taking the same kind of approach to Facebook. But how do you foresee that looking? Is it, the job of lawmakers and policymakers to figure that one out? Or what's your proposal there?
I don't have a good one, but when a company achieves this kind of dominance, and traditionally, this has triggered antitrust review. It's not illegal to be in a monopoly. It's illegal to abuse one. And what I'd like to see in general, and this would not just be trying to regulate. I don't like regulation. I'd rather avoid that if possible. I'd like to see a lot of different people, including government, think about how do we inject more competition, re-inject competition into this world that was massively distributed and decentralized, but is becoming radically centralized again. How do we do something about that? I don't know if government wants to. I think government kind of likes it when there are these choke points that it can apply pressure to itself. But that's what I really want to see is for politicians and others. It's why I'm happy Republicans suddenly realized they were getting, that they might be under the control of one media company. If we, the solution to these things is all, the best solution is always competition rather than regulation. But I don't see much of either being done. And that's really what worries me.
I also wonder if this is not just inevitable. I mean, Tim Wu in the Master Switch kind of predicted that this would happen. As, this is when companies are small and businesses are small and they're new, there's a lot of ferment, a lot of creativity, a lot of competition. But then money starts pouring in. The incumbents move in. New companies become incumbents like Facebook. And we're right back to the old way of doing things. Isn't that kind of what's happened?
To a degree, yes. And there are some real advantages to centralization. I'm not disputing that.
Yes,
but
there's the economy of scale.
But the fact that we're it's I'm not sure that scale is the right word for the economy here, but there's things that can be done better.
But look what happened. I mean, you even point this out in your article. As Facebook got bigger, all it did is it just swooped up all the little, it starts scooping them in. Anybody who could be a competitor, yeah. If it's WhatsApp, got it. Instagram, got it. They just swoop in. I mean, they try to get Snapchat. They haven't been able to get it.
So that, you know, that by itself suggests that something that there needs to be thing. If for example, Facebook announced tomorrow that it was buying Slack, I would hope that people at the antitrust division would like awaken from their Rip Van Winkle sleep and say, oh, okay, this is too much.
That is a false hope. You know that is never going to happen.
And if they're asleep during Democratic administrations, they're going to be put to sleep in Republican administrations.
We are talking about Facebook, the news. We're going to talk a little bit about the Google Oracle case that's on right now. I'm glad Denise Howell is here. She can help us understand how you could possibly copyright an API. And a whole lot more. Steve Kovac is also here from techinsider.io. Are you going to Google I.O. This week?
No, I'm in New York. My colleagues out west are going to be covering it.
Yeah. We'll be doing coverage, of course, our own coverage of Google I.O. Jason Howell of All About Android is going to be there. Jeff Jarvis from This Week in Google and Father Robert Ballasaire from Know How and Twyatt will all three be at the keynote. We'll be covering the keynote, streaming it live as we always do on Wednesday, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1700 UTC. You can, of course, watch Google Stream, but it's so much more fun to watch us snark about Google Stream behind the scenes. I hope you join us for that. And then a special This Week in Google at 2 p.m. Pacific. And Jeff and Jason will be joining us. I think we've got a space inside of the Googleplex to stream them from. So I think there's going to be some interesting stuff. We'll talk about what we're expecting at Google I.O. also a little later on the show. Our show today brought to you by Blue Apron. This Week in Tech, sponsored by This Week in Cooking. I love Blue Apron. Blue Apron solves the problem of what to eat for dinner. Yeah, you could go to the fast food restaurant, or you could just take what's in the refrigerator. I don't think there's much I can do with mustard and peanut butter, but I'll find a way. Or Blue Apron Day. I love coming home and finding the Blue Apron box on the porch. There's three separate meals in there. Always interesting, too. I mean, it's really about unusual ingredients, amazing recipes that you wouldn't think of buying. I don't have to go to the grocery store because they've done all the shopping for me exactly what I want. There's no waste. You know, if it calls for one rib of celery, that's what's in there. There's always exactly what you need to make the recipe. It's all fresh from local farms, sustainably produced. Seafood is sourced sustainably. Beef is raised humanely. Chickens are free range. The pork is natural. And always fresh, never frozen, which I really like. They use regenerative farming practices for produce. And you're going to find some unusual ingredients you've never cooked before. Let's see what's on the menu this week. Crispy cod and cabbage slaw tacos with pepita, pineapple, and avocado salsa. See, I don't know what pepita is. But see, once you've used it, you go, oh, I'm going to use more pepita. Whatever. That's good stuff. I love that pepita. How about crispy catfish? And what is that? Yuzu koshu udon. I know udon's noodles. See, and the thing is, you can make this. You can make it in half hour to 45 minutes. And your family's going to go, wow, catfish for dinner. Pan-seared pork chops with two cheese, mashed potatoes, and sautéed spinach. They have plans for couples. Great for date night. It's really, really nice for date night. But they also have family plans with kid-friendly ingredients. And what a great way to get the kids cooking. Blue Apron delivers right to your door 99% of the continental United States. They support healthy families. In fact, Blue Apron families cook three times more often. So, you know, I know the kids are going to say, pizza tonight again? No, we're cooking tonight with Blue Apron. I want you to try your first two meals free and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. You'll love how good it feels, how great it tastes. The house fills with this amazing aroma. The kids say, what's for dinner? This is good. It's hard to do this at my mouth always waters because I start thinking about my Blue Apron. BlueApron.com/twit. Your first two meals are free with free shipping. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. Dan Gilmore is here from the Walter Cronkite School for Mass Communication and Media. He teaches media literacy to young people. Aren't they media literate?
Well, they're getting a lot better at it. I actually did a massive online course that was mostly older people, which was even more fun in some ways.
You know, I remember talking to, what was his name? Richard Hart. Remember he used to do Next Step, mm-hmm. and he was on CNET. And Richard's now teaching technology and journalism to a school in San Francisco, Academy of Art. I said, it must be great, Richard, to work with young people who are so technically literate. He said, no, they know less than we do, Leo. Because we grew up, we had to figure this stuff out. They just were handed it on a platter. They have no idea how anything works.
Well, we could say the same about our generation and cars.
That's right. Because we were just given cars. We don't know how to fix them. Yeah.
I learned to change the oil, and that was a victory.
I learned to change the oil and tune it up and set the timing, and then they made it so you couldn't do that anymore.
That's true, and now you can't even,
you need a computer.
In many places, plug your own stuff in because it's going to violate copyright law.
Anyway, I think it must be interesting to work with young people, and I find it ironic that this internet generation... I'm starting to think this whole idea of the internet natives, wait till they get a grow up, they grew up with the internet, they're going to know how to... They're going to have it appreciate. I used to say this. It's going to be, you don't know what this medium is going to turn out to be until people who've grown up with it get to work on it. Now I'm wondering.
You know, they're really pretty savvy about media.
And I hope so.
I think I said earlier to you that I think it's healthy that they basically don't trust anything that they see anymore, except their friends who they should trust a little bit less. But it's progress to me that they're intensely skeptical of what they see in the media.
Yeah. But is that a kind of, I hope it's not a cynicism either. I mean, young people should not be cynical yet.
It borders on cynicism in many cases, and I agree with you, that's a problem. But it's perhaps, it would be worse if they were just trusting it.
Yeah. Denise, your son is how old?
He's 12.
Yeah. He's right at that age. We have a 13-year-old at home. And I watch and Michael doesn't use Facebook yet. He doesn't even have a Facebook account because you're supposed to be 13. And there's not a lot of pressure to create a Facebook account. I remember when my kids got to that age, they really wanted that Facebook account. Not so much anymore. Michael gets all his entertainment, all his news, all his everything from YouTube, period.
Yep.
That's true of yours as well, I'm sure.
Yes, it is. He's not dying for Facebook. He's dying for Instagram.
Instagram.
So, yes.
That makes sense.
Ready
there's
to
too
go
much,
there.
There's too much text and prose on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Just give me a picture. So maybe we don't have to worry about Facebook at all. Maybe that's a problem for our generation and not for theirs. Minecraft Con is in Anaheim. September 24th, MineCon. Why does your son want to go to MineCon? It's $160 bucks, by the way.
Yeah, it is. We were talking at the top of the show as you were introducing Steve about how much you can do with Minecraft.
Right.
And that explains why he's still engaged in it. He's used it for years. He'll do a camp this summer that's all about... exploring and being creative with Minecraft. But one of the reasons it's so powerful is that it's such an open system.
Right.
There's so much you can do with it. No one has ever, Mojang and now Microsoft following the same path, has said, you know, here are the building blocks, build what you want, and really aren't asserting ownership at all in what people build. So you can, there are all these various... probably thousands and thousands of servers out there where you can do different things on Minecraft. And one of the things my son is really into is playing factions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically video games built on the platform,
right,
where you can go in and play a game that someone invented.
Yeah, I like it. I so much prefer to see him playing that than Call of Duty or, heaven forbid, Grand Theft Auto. Because it's like Lego. And it gets kids, you know, into computers in an interesting way. I really think that the Minecraft universe and the building blocks of Minecraft universe actually prepare people better than we might think for engineering jobs, for technology jobs. There's something about it that really kind of fosters this sense. You're learning kind of how pieces fit together, the consequences of different actions. You know, I find it fascinating. We ended up setting up our own Minecraft server. Actually, three of them in my house. And I even kind of got sucked into it for a while. I would stay up till 3 a.m. building stuff. And then you start writing software in Python, and it's kind of the sky's the limit on this. You know what I love is that Microsoft never did what probably was very tempting, which is to, A, raise the price in Minecraft, or better yet, give it, it's only $27, but give it away and then charge for textures and bitmaps, you know, do the in-app purchase thing. I'm sure that must have been tempting. I'm sure there was.
Right, and they let other people do that.
Right.
So if you have a Minecraft server where you've created this whole world, and yeah, you can charge for the weapons and all that stuff. So they're letting people build their own businesses.
Yeah, it's very interesting. All right, let's talk about Google versus Oracle. And I'm very curious what y'all think of this. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going to try to give you the timeline. And Denise, I'm sure you'll fix it if I screw it up. I interviewed James Gosling about 3 weeks ago, the guy who wrote Java. And Sun, which was the company he was working for, that owned Java, made Java open. People could develop for Java. They even said you could, I guess, write your own Javas. Of course, at one point, Google came to them, or maybe it was Andy Rubin before. It probably was Andy Rubin before Android was sold to Google. Said, "I want to put Android on. I want to make it a Java-based operating system. Can we license it?" They talked. There was no license deal. But Andy decided he didn't need to do a license deal because it was an open platform, created his own Java virtual machine called Dalvik. Google bought Android. Oracle bought Sun. And the interesting thing is, Gosling told me this. He said, we saw Google's code and we felt like it was a little slimy, that Google didn't just kind of do clean room development of Dalvik. It looked like some of our code was in their code. It felt like we saw bits and pieces of our stuff in their code. It probably wasn't clean room, but it wasn't to the point where we were going to sue them. Well, it's like, oh, that's slimy, but we were upset, but we didn't plan on doing anything about it. He says, but when the negotiations between Oracle and Sun began in earnest, and he was in the room talking about this, he said, I saw the Oracle lawyer's eyes light up. They knew they had something. And they knew there could be a big payday at the end of the line. Oracle ended up suing Google. He said, the thing I really disagree with is that they didn't sue them over stealing the code. He said, the lawyers apparently decided that wasn't a winnable case. They copyrighted the API and then went after them for stealing the API, which is really kind of antithetical to the way the whole computer industry works. I mean, because of APIs, everything can talk to everything. We wouldn't have the PC industry if you hadn't been able to copy the interface to IBM's BIOS so that you could make IBM-compatible computers. That just wouldn't have happened. So everything from then on really relies on this idea that APIs are free and open and can be duplicated. Oracle lost. Now, I'm not sure the timeline on this. They lost the case. The case was appealed, turned down, appealed again, turned down. Finally, Oracle appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, which decided we're not going to hear the case.
Not just yet.
Tell me about
that. They tried to get the Supreme Court involved before the entire case had been resolved. It got sent back down for trial, which is what is going to start a retrial on a particular issue. The fair use question, which is going to, and a couple of other things are going to happen next week. So the Supreme Court just declined to get involved at an early juncture. It could still get involved later on. Once there's been a trial and we have a final determination from the trial court, I'm sure there will be another appeal, whoever wins or loses, because the stakes are so high on both sides here. And at that point, the Supreme Court could say, okay, you know, we think this is an important issue and get involved. But it's up to them.
I'll tell you how high the stakes are. Oracle's suing for, I used to say for $9 billion. It's actually 9.3. And I realize when you talk about 0.3 at that level, it's $300 million. So we're not going to leave that part out. $9.3 billion. I think the trial has begun. There's testimony. So I think the trial has begun. In court this week, Jonathan Schwartz, the last CEO at Sun, testifying kind of really on Google's behalf along with Eric Schmidt.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm a week off. Yes,
yeah. We started this week. Yeah. And yeah. It's in front of the judge, William Alsup, who we celebrated. So he was the judge before, and ruled in Google's favor. And we celebrated him because we thought finally, a judge who knows something about this. He was a math major, but he said he taught himself Java so that he could rule on this case. And I think he even said, last night I wrote a bubble sort or something. I can't remember the exact thing. But anyway, we thought, wow, this guy's good. And so it's back in front of him. Basically, the court said it back to him. And it's a jury trial now, which is a little nerve-wracking. It's a jury of 10 people. And apparently, there was at one point one person potentially on the jury who knew about technology and was bumped off by Oracle. So there's all, so basically it's 10 normal people who don't know anything about the subject at hand. And I don't feel like, Steve, these are people who are capable of ruling on something like, you know, what, do they even know what an API is?
Yeah, I think that's what that motherboard piece really focuses on. Man. This is such... Like you just said about what the importance of what an API is and how it, you know, we wouldn't be talking over Skype right now, right?
So
the fact that people who don't even clearly grasp what that is, and they bump the one person who does grasp what that is off the jury, that's dangerous almost. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how they're arguing. I haven't listened to any of the testimony or anything. The lawyers are phrasing everything such that the jury can understand it and distill it down to so they can understand the true importance of what this means for the computing industry in general. It's really worrying, actually. That motherboard particle's scary.
But they're not talking about
this
the
trial.
API.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Purposes of this trial, they don't have to decide whether APIs are copyrightable or not. That's already been determined, and now they're determining whether Google has a defense.
Whether they violated the copyright.
Right. Yeah. And
right. Whether fair use applies.
The reading I did on the first few days of this, and not being there, this is by definition superficial. It sure sounded like Google played fast and loose in a lot of ways, and the internal emails that they kept pulling out were horrible.
Yeah.
But I do want to come back to this idea that the APIs can be copyrighted. That's catastrophic for technology.
You tweeted it could be the end of let me read the tweet. If the open web dies, Oracle will be one of its killers thanks to the terrible, horrible API case. And you're quoting a very good article in Ars Technica by Joe Mullen about this.
Yeah, it's the contempt I'm feeling for Oracle right now is pretty enormous.
I don't want to. Larry Ellison is not my favorite person in the world. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So I think I got this a little bit wrong. So the judge said that API should not be eligible for copyright. That was the right thing.
Right. Then there was an appeal.
The Oracle appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals, which said they are creative works and should be copyrighted. And that's when the Supreme Court said, "Well, we're not gonna
exactly,
yeah,
we're not touching that yet. We're gonna let this run its course." And
so, what could happen here then is that the jury could say, "Oh yeah, it's not fair use. $9.3 billion to Google. Would Google then try to appeal that ruling, or would they go back to the Supreme Court about this whole notion of whether you can copyright an API? Because that's, I don't care about $9.3 billion for Google. That's one thing. I care about copywriting APIs. That seems like a very dangerous precedent.
Right. And once there's been a trial and we determine, you know, the appellate court has already said, okay, we think APIs are copyrightable. You need to finish up your trial. Which you didn't do the first time, trial court, because you decided they weren't copyrightable.
He threw it out.
Yes. So you need to go back and have a trial on that issue and see if Google's fair use defense flies before a jury, and they'll go through applying the fair use analysis and see how Google fares there. And then once there's a final decision on that point, they once again, they can't go straight to the Supreme Court. They have to appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And let the the Ninth Circuit has already spoken on that one substantive issue that is so important to you, Leo. So if they say the same thing again, at that point, Google can knock on the Supreme Court's door and try and involve them. But again, that's purely up to the Supreme Court. They don't have to take cases.
Wasn't it though the it wasn't the Ninth Circuit though? Wasn't it
the D.C. Court of Appeals?
That loves everything that has intellectual property. Yeah,
it attached. Went to the federal circuit, according to Joe, because they hear all patent appeals, and mm-hmm. and Google prevailed on the patent claims. Oracle did not appeal the patent claims, but because the patent claim was in there, it went to federal circuit. Right. And actually, I think the Ninth Circuit is I would guess, a little more sophisticated and maybe perhaps more sympathetic to Google, yes or no?
Yeah, you're probably right. I was thinking Ninth Circuit because they're back in trial in San Francisco,
right.
But you're absolutely right.
No, it went to the Federal Circuit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit, I think, would probably, they're much more tech savvy, partially because of their location.
Mm-hmm.
One would, but again, this is... What really scares me is this seems to be in the hands of people who have a fairly thin grasp of what it all means. Maybe I'm giving too much weight to Sarah Jong's Motherboard article, because she quotes from some of the testimony. It was kind of a little chilling. The headline is, "In Oracle versus Google, a nerd subculture is on trial." And her point, at least her analysis of this, is that the jury is trying to get wrap its head around things like free software in the sense of open source, you know, liberated software. And at one point, a part of the problem is that you've got Jonathan Schwartz, who's trying to explain what an API is by talking about hamburgers on breakfast menus in restaurants, which the judge said, "I don't understand one word of what he says." "I don't know what the witness just said. The thing about breakfast menu makes no sense." Oh, boy.
Right. Well, there are, I think, a couple of ways that Google could pull this out ultimately. I mean, right now it has to live with this determination that APIs and this particular API is copyrightable.
They can't dispute that. That's already been decided.
That's been decided for purposes of this trial. But, you know, ultimately, hopefully, they'll get to take another whack at that one.
So this is a fair use case?
Yeah, because they now have to argue that, okay, if it's subject to copyright, we get to use it anyway. I'm hoping that somewhere in here, and I, like Dan, not there at trial, haven't read the briefs, et cetera, but I'm hoping that an implied license argument is being made as well, because they didn't have an express license anywhere. But maybe the way that the parties conducted themselves and what Google was led to believe, you know, you can't just sort of take back making something open simply because there's been a change of management and lawyers with a gleam in their eye.
Right, right.
So hopefully they do have some latches and estoppel arguments. Those are ways of saying you waited too long and you led us to believe that, you know, you led us down the primrose path and led us to build things in reliance on what we reasonably believed.
Do you think it's
and,
a case that the,
so those kinds of arguments
that the jury Sorry. Could handle this, that this is not a technical argument?
I think so. I mean,
that a reasonable, non-technical human could have an opinion on this.
I think so. I mean, lawyers all the time in technology cases have to distill very complicated issues in a way that juries can understand. And, you know, the copyrightability question, I think, is really, really hard. But with that off the table for purposes of this trial, then you're into the whole fair use analysis, which, while kind of a wild card, and it doesn't fit this case very well, we're used to fair use being applied in different contexts. It's really hard to think about an API as a creative work, and that's why the copyrightability question is so controversial to begin with.
Yeah.
But if the jury's just asked to, you know, whether they misled Google and these latches and estoppel arguments should apply, or whether Google hit the four fair use factors, that should be something a jury can process.
The four factors are those little rules about what makes something fair use, having to do with transformative. What are they again? Transformative use?
The purpose of the use. Why did you use it?
Right.
The nature of the work. You know, is it a highly creative work that your use?
I think Android's pretty damn creative.
The amount used. How much of the copyrighted work did you use? Did you use a portion
of
it?
Or all of the API. 37 calls. How much did you use? How much did you use of the API? Because if you only use a little of the API, that's okay.
And the effect on the market for the work. So
that
if you
might be one
something.
Where Oracle would have something to say, right? Because if
Google creates its own version of an API, does that mean that Oracle's version? Well, yeah.
It undermines the value of Java. Well, I'm not going to. I don't want to give the lawyers any arguments, but it undermines the value of Java if anybody could come along and say, "Well, I don't need Java. I'll just duplicate the API." That, I think you could say that undermines the value of Java. But your point's well taken that was the intent of Java. That's what Sun's intent was before Oracle came along.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always thought this was a fascinating issue when I first started practicing and looking at APIs. And you know, in some instances, people license them.
Right.
And in other instances, they're open and they're widely known as open.
Well, it's kind of the nature of an API. You have to publish an API if you want people to use it, because if they don't know the API, then they don't know how to use your stuff. So the API is always to some degree open. There are hidden API calls. Microsoft always kept some to itself, secret, you know, Microsoft API calls that only it could use. But or at least that was the assertion that we always used to make. How do you feel, Dan? Are you bullish on this or are you worried?
I'm really worried. I think this could be pretty disastrous for open technology in general. There's a lot of things that we use every day that completely rely on the interoperability of technology and the web, et cetera.
Right.
And if suddenly that all, if you need permission at every step, that's not good.
Right. It stifles innovation. And you got to love a company that names its AI engine Parsi McParsface. I think this is a little tip of the hat to Bodie McBoatface.
Yeah.
Remember the open vote, the British research vessel, the Antarctic research vessel. They asked for names, you know, and they suggested Endeavor and, you know, lots of good names. And the internet decided it should be named Bodie McBoatface. And then the agency that was naming the boat did a turnaround and said, well, we're going to name it anyway. We're not going to name it that. Well, Google decided, I guess maybe as a consolation prize, to name its AI project Parsi McParsface. And by the way, Sundar Pichai tweeted that. Our state-of-the-art language parsing model is now open source for you to use. Google plays fast and loose with the idea of open source and so forth too, right? I mean, they've always said, oh, Android's open. Android's open source. And I guess technically it is. But at the same time, there's considerable restrictions on how you can use it if you want to have Google services. In other words, if you want it to be fully functional. And that's one of the things that the EU doesn't like. Bodie McVoteface was named RRS Sir David Attenborough. Thank you very much.
That's a good name, too. I love David Attenborough.
Yeah, who doesn't love David Attenborough?
That's still.
100,000 people voted for Bodie McVoteface. Oh, Sir David Attenborough. All right, let's take a break, come back with more. I want to talk more about Google I.O. What do you expect? It's just around the corner on Wednesday. There's lots to talk about, as always. Microsoft says Windows 10 is now on 300 million active devices, and only half of those were upgraded behind people's backs. So, no, just joking.
Uh-oh.
Ooh, joking. I somehow annoyed Windows people. I got all these tweets saying, stop it. I don't even know what I said. Our show today brought to you by my mattress. I love my Casper. A good night's sleep. We're learning more and more is about health, about your, you know, not just how you feel during the day, but your overall health. You need to get a good night's sleep. And if your mattress is keeping you awake, I've got a solution. A premium mattress you buy direct from the manufacturer, made in the USA, and you save so much money because they don't have to pay for showrooms. It's Casper. You get your springy latex foam, plus your supportive memory foam to give you an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And I say that because I know it, because here it is, my Casper mattress. We got a queen. You saw how small that box is. That's the other thing I love about Casper. I got a queen for my son in college, too, because he was on the third floor, no elevator. And I said, it's so easy for him to get it upstairs. Look at that. Talk about sink and bounce. Support. You get free delivery, and I know some people say, oh, I'm not going to buy a mattress without lying on it. Well, here's the good news. You can lie on it for 100 nights, and if at any time in those 100 nights you say, yeah, it's not right for me, you call them, they'll come and get it, they'll refund you every penny. Every penny. They're made to uphold the highest environmental production standards. When I open that box, there's no smell. You don't have to air it out. It's great. And by the way, talk about breathing. It breathes. This is a cool, comfortable mattress. You get free shipping, of course, and free returns in the U.S. and Canada. $500 for a twin, $950 for a king size. We're going to save you even more because you can get an additional $50 towards the mattress if you go to Casper, CASPER.com/twit. And using the promo code TWIT, Casper.com/TWIT, promo code TWIT, terms and conditions apply. $50 off your award-winning sleep surface. It's not a mattress, it's a sleep surface. Okay, it's a mattress. It's a very nice mattress. We do love it, and I hope you will enjoy your mattress. But if you don't, return it. They'll refund every single penny. Don't forget the Casper pillows and sheets and all that, too. The pillows are great. We fight, Lisa and I fight over our Casper pillows. I want my pillow. We got two, so we wouldn't fight over the pillow. Thank you, Casper, for your support of This Week in Tech. And thank you to our team, our panel this week, Stephen Kovac from TechInsider.io. Great to have you at Steve Kovac, K-O-V-A-C on the H on the Twitter. Denise Howell, she's an attorney. She's not making this stuff up. She's trained, a professional, and a host of This Week in Law. Every Friday on Twit. Great, must-listen-to show. You'll probably talk about this a little bit, the Google Oracle thing on the...
We will indeed, yeah.
Yeah. You find fun stuff, too, though. It's like...
Well, there's a good link, actually, between this Google Oracle dispute, and we had the lawyer on recently who wrote the brief in Klingon that you've probably read about.
Yeah, Warner Brothers says, right. we copyright a Klingon. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, copywriting a language and copywriting an API are fairly similar.
Oh, interesting.
Issues. Yeah.
Huh.
So, in fact, someone who wanted the Supreme Court to intervene in the Google case when the Supreme Court declined to made the pitch that you should find that languages like Klingon are not subject to copyright, and APIs are likewise a system not subject to copyright, but it didn't persuade the court.
You must have loved this brief filed by the Language Creation Society in this case. They challenged Paramount's claim of copyright over Klingon. I guess somebody's making a fan film or something that has Klingon in it. Paramount says you can't use Klingon. The amicus brief.
Paramount doesn't like the whole film.
Yeah, they don't want. That's really, they're just trying to shut down the fan film, right? The amicus brief is, according to, this is from an article in Reason, is peppered with Klingon words and phrases, even quoting the Big Lebowski in Klingon, "Not kam guvam." This will not stand, man. In response to the idea that anyone expressing anything in Klingon would be a copyright infringer.
Yes.
Alex Spears' dad taught him Klingon at an early age.
I highly recommend. The brief didn't actually get permission to get filed in that case. It was lodged, and the court decided it did not need the help of the party that filed.
Wait a minute. The court can turn down an amicus brief?
Yes. The court, that's a purely optional thing.
They can go like, I'm not listening. Na, 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 na. I don't want to hear you. Na, 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 na.
Yeah, because the amicus is not a party to the lawsuit. They're just someone who's interested in the outcome and who wants to help educate the court on the issues. And the parties have page limits. You know, they can only pack so much into their briefs. So amicus briefs are helpful for points that didn't get raised in the original briefs.
That I understand. If I were the judge.
Did they write the brief in Klingon?
Yeah, part of it, yeah.
Part of it, yes. Mark Randazza is the lawyer. He is so funny. Folks, I definitely, not to plug my own show, but he was great on This Week in Law when we had him on. He's a First Amendment lawyer, Dan, and he was the guy who put Righthaven out of business and has had all kinds of really interesting cases in his career and just was approached by these folks who wanted to submit this amicus brief and just knocked it out of the park. I mean, the brief is not long. I highly recommend it. I usually don't recommend that people go read legal briefs, but this one is so clever and so well-written. And they even managed to find a Klingon font to write out the Klingon language in the brief.
Mark has a good sense of humor, I must say. Yes. Yeah. And it's like a real brief and everything. By the way, here's the introduction. There is no word for love in the Klingon language. They don't need it. They don't need it. Some things just remain unsaid. As the Klingon proverb says, I can see why the court turned this down. As the Klingon proverb says, did you get Mark to actually read some of these Klingon phrases?
No, we had Emery, my co-host, was the only one brave enough to try and pronounce the Klingon.
So funny. Oh, my God. So you're of the opinion that one can neither copyright an API nor a language. Even if somebody made up the language, like, because this was made up.
It was made up, but by the people who it's not a great analogy to an API.
Okay.
Because
it was a creative work. I mean, somebody made up a language.
Right. Right. But there were some lines of Klingon that were generated for Paramount for some of the original series episodes. And then Klingon just took on a life of its own. And people, you know, basically it was the fans who created the language.
Oh, I see. So there were only a few lines created for the show.
Right. Yes.
Well, if it's a fan-created language, Paramount does not own it. Come on, Paramount.
We will see. It's going to be an interesting... the movie, the crowd-funded movie they're seeking to make is called Axanar, and it looks like it's going to be great. but, you know, the Klingon is not the only aspect of the... would-be movie that Paramount's taking issue with. Use of the costumes, use of Vulcan ears, various copyrighted components they're claiming make the film impossible.
Historically, they've been very protective of the of Star Trek. I remember somebody, who was it? There's a description of what the Enterprise should be that is very minute. And if you know, when they made, I guess, the reboot or whatever, you have to have everything exactly right. They treat this as a very serious subject. There's no messing around with Paramount on this subject. Let's talk about Apple. The we talked about it last week, and I've been very quick to say you shouldn't blame users. Jim Dalrymple and James Pinkstone both have complained that Apple's Apple Music deleted files on their computer. Pinkstone, who's a designer, said 120 gigabytes of music files. After he matched it in Apple Music, Apple's software just deleted it. This is behavior that, you know, most of us who use Apple Music have never seen before, but enough people have reported it that I hate to say it's their fault. I think a lot of people, including some Apple press, said, it must have been their fault. Well, maybe not. Now Apple says there may be bugs in iTunes. Could happen. Just in case, we're going to fix something. We're not admitting anything, but just in case, we're putting out a patch next week. That's not an admission. That's just, you know, just we're just going to be, here's what they wrote. In an extremely small number of cases, users have reported that music files saved on their computer were removed without their permission. We're taking these reports seriously. Good for Apple. As we know how important music is to our customers, and our teams are focused on identifying the cause. Here's the key, though. We have not been able to reproduce this issue, which usually you need to do if there's a bug. We need to be able to show how that happens. However, we are releasing an update to iTunes early next week, which includes additional safeguards. So they haven't fixed, if there's a bug, they haven't found it, and they haven't fixed it, but they're going to do something extra. If a user experiences this issue, they should contact Apple Care. Don't know. I don't know if you can say this is victory for Jim Dalrymple and James Pinkstone, or if Apple's just, I think, probably doing the right thing.
Assuming it even fixes the issue, I mean.
Well, if they don't know what the problem is, you can't fix it.
Right. How, exactly. So what is this patch if they can't recreate the bug, or right. If it is a bug or whatever it is? It sounds like they don't even know. And so I don't even know what this patch means. And if it's really oddly worded statement. I mean, great that they're taking it seriously. And it's also great that they're supposedly totally revamping Apple Music again this summer. So hopefully they get a lot of those kinks ironed out.
They need to tear this sucker down.
Yeah, just start, burn it down, start from the beginning. It's just use Spotify. Spotify is so great.
I think that's Apple's fear. I mean, they have 13 million paid users, which is pretty good for Apple Music.
For not even a year.
For not even a year. And they started really at 100,000. Beats Music was not burning up the
right
charts. But it's still a fraction of the 30 million that Spotify has. And I think Apple really wants this to succeed, so they need to. And iTunes is terrible. They really need to fix it. I'm a little disheartened by the early reports of what they're going to do. They'll announce this, I'm sure, at WWDC. According to 9to5 Mac, it's just going to have a new sidebar and a refreshed media picker and things like that. That's not what it needs. Start from scratch. We've seen enough patching on iTunes. No more patching it.
There's at least a little legal CYA going on here, too. If you have a piece of software that's in an unauthorized fashion deleting files off people's computers, that opens you up.
Not good.
They yes. have to make sure that that's yes. not happening.
That would not be a good thing.
Given the terms of service, though, that basically say it in most software, whatever goes wrong, tough.
Right.
How would anyone win a case on this?
Well, it would be tough, but they wouldn't want to have to fight off a class action on it, I'm sure.
In fact, that's what James Pinkstone's blog post pointed out. He actually quotes from the Apple terms of service. Apple stole my music. No, seriously. And he uses it to prove his point. He says, if you read the terms of service, it's clear Apple was prepared for such a thing and made sure that they weren't going to be... You can show that. We're going to be...
That's fine.
He says, "This is." We're showing a picture of the middle finger, and the caption is, Apple's terms of use abridged. it says, when your Apple Music subscription term ends, you will lose access to any songs stored in your iCloud music library. You expressly agree that your use of or inability to use the Apple Music service is at your sole risk. Of course, this is boilerplate. Every company has this. In no cases shall we be liable for any direct, incidental, indirect, punitive, special, or consequential damages. Any loss or damage of any kind is... See, this isn't a smoking gun. This is in every contract.
Right. And it's just good practice by the lawyers to put it in there, but that doesn't mean it's under the right circumstances or in all circumstances going to be enforceable.
Right. 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 You could still sue them. You could sue them for anything. You might even win, as we've learned. Mm-hmm. You never know what's going to happen. Now, here's an interesting article that I really did want to talk about with all of you because, I found it. This is from a website by Neil Seibert called Above Avalon. And the analysis is quite interesting. He's taking a look at Apple's R&D, their research and development costs. In the past, it's been pointed out by many that Apple's R&D costs are unusually low for a company of its size with its cash. But all of a sudden, starting in 2010, the costs started to ramp up rather rapidly, and they have increased significantly. $10 billion a year in 2016, that's up 30% from a year ago. And just 4 years ago, Apple was spending $3 billion. So from $3 to $10 billion in just 4 years. He says, this is evidence, and I think this is interesting, that Apple is about to pivot. Now, I think he's using pivot in a way that I don't, that is not kind of common usage. Usually what you mean when you say pivot, at least with a startup, is what they were doing didn't work, so they're going to try something else. It's pretty clear what Apple's doing is working. There's no need for Apple to pivot. On the other hand, I think there's significant interest in having the next iPhone. And that's where you do a lot of R&D.
Yeah, I didn't read this as, you know, when you say pivot, it's not even the next iPhone, which is what, another personal computing device. And I don't think we're going to see that kind of revolution in personal computing. You know, I'm going to be an old guy before that happens. I think when he says pivot, he means a whole new kind of category. And the obvious category is transportation. There's that $1 billion investment in the Chinese company. I'm going to pronounce it wrong. Is it Didi or Didi?
I don't know. It's the Uber of China.
Uber of China, which is...
Let's call it that.
Yeah, the Uber of China, Didi. So it's clear they're thinking not just building a car that you're going to go and buy a physical object, but it's also clear that they're thinking the transportation and mobility services, which is super interesting and very ambitious. And that's not personal computing. It's maybe enabled by... You know, you still call the car with your phone, but that's just a wild new step for them, assuming that's where all this R&D spending is going. So a physical car plus this concept of mobility services, which there are already some startups working on that now, like that Faraday Future startup. And even Ford is thinking about this and GM. So the fact that Apple is going to be going after that kind of market is a pivot in their business. It's not a personal computing play. It's going
I guess you're right. I mean, that is a pivot, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. It could be wearables, though. I mean, we don't know what they're spending that money on. We know they spent, as you said, $1 billion on the acquisition.
Right. Or the investment. Yeah.
Investment.
Yeah.
But we don't know what the $10 billion is. It could be in the next iPhone. It could be in the next Apple Watch. It could be on anything, right? They don't break it down.
Right. And then you look at Samsung. I mean, Samsung spends maybe 10 or 15 billion a year, something crazy like that. They've been spending it. Now they're involved in everything from shipbuilding to life insurance, but so they're just a conglomerate.
$14 billion in 2015.
Yeah, so there you go.
But they're a much bigger company, or maybe not. Right. They are. Yeah.
They have their hand in everything. I mean, if you go to South Korea, Samsung is everywhere. They're, 30% of the GDP or something. So they touch everything, not just phones and chips. It's not pivot and Silicon Valley talk, like the way you and I used to talking about it. But for Apple to go from a personal computing company into this whole new aspect of just getting people around, whether it's through a Uber-like service or an actual vehicle, that's huge. That's a huge fundamental shift. And I totally agree with Neil that they're working on such a shift.
Would it be autonomous electric vehicles, Project Titan? Would that
I mean, there's always autonomy. I don't think they're going to have full autonomy.
Not fully autonomous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Tesla's already have the semi-autonomous autopilot and things like that. That's where you kind of start now. But I think the more interesting thing is actually that service. I think that's the fact that you don't need to own a car, especially in urban areas. That's just a huge opportunity for any car company now. Fact that you just call the car when you need it, or you get one where you need it. It's like Spotify for cars. I think that's a more interesting play than even just building an electric car.
Right. Is it credible, Dan, you think? I mean, you've been watching Apple for practically since the beginning, that they might do this kind of massive shift in business. There wouldn't even be a computer company anymore.
Well, I think it would be a computer company. I think I don't know if they're going to do a car. It wouldn't surprise me, but Apple strategy for the last number of years has been to make Apple the center of your digital life. And as everything we touch and this is kind of scary, but everything we touch is getting or already has software in it and memory and is connected to digital networks. Apple could make a very strong play in being the hub of our increasingly digital existence. And that might include transportation. It makes perfect sense that it would. But the whole, you know, that the entertainment portion of many people's homes is all Apple at this point. That could expand out into the badly named Internet of Things and onward. So if Apple is being the Apple I think I understand, I think they're going for much bigger thing than simply software that runs cars. I think it's a much bigger thing if this is what I think it is.
Yeah. Denise, what would you do if you were Apple right now? I mean, you had probably the most successful technology product of all time in the iPhone, and it's starting to taper off. You can't sell anymore as many as you used to. The growth has tapered off. The iPad didn't really take over. The Apple Watch didn't. Do you have to find the next big thing, or do you just kind of coast on what you got?
No, I think I'd keep building on the fact that so many people are so invested in iOS at this point.
It's an opportunity, and, isn't it? You've got this captive audience.
Just what Dan was saying, that you know, the more they can expand out in IRC, they're talking about the iFridge.
I am not buying a refrigerator from Apple. I'm sorry. That doesn't.
Right. I'm stunned they haven't done, you know, they have Apple TV, but I was always thinking they would do the actual physical monitor.
Yeah. You make such a good point,
waiting
though.
Waiting for that.
That what Apple probably should be looking at is ways to capitalize on the very devoted fans who are locked into their ecosystem. You know, people who own iPhones tend to also own other Apple stuff. They tend to use, I would imagine, Apple Music over other music solutions. Lock these guys in. You've got them. Build on that. And I don't know if a car does that. A car is a pivot in the sense that it's just a completely separate thing. And you're entering a market where there are already companies that have that kind of loyalty and lock-in.
And well, iOS, I mean, Apple is trying to, you know, monetize those iOS users a lot more. I mean, the last two earnings calls, and if you want to be cynical, it's because iPhone sales are down and they were projecting them to be down. But they are talking more and more about services revenue, what that looks like. I mean, Apple Music is part of it. App Store sales are part of it. iCloud storage subscriptions and so forth. What their big challenge is, I mean, a lot of theirs just suck right now.
That's the real problem. They made $9 million on it last quarter, but it sucks.
Right. So their big challenge, you know, on that side, their core business right now is to make that not suck and make it good and make it a pleasurable experience, that when you know, I store stuff in iCloud, it's going to be available, or iMessage syncs correctly between all my devices, and just numerous little glitches throughout their entire services ecosystem. When I search for an app, I get the app I'm looking for. I don't get a bunch of clones and garbage.
It's terrible.
I think, or was it last week or 2 weeks ago, the App Store search just totally borked, and you'd search Instagram and you'd get like just garbage. You know, so there's a lot of holes in their services, and there's a huge opportunity there, and they see it, but they haven't really proven that they can fix it.
Although it does show you the benefit of lock-in is, as bad as Apple services are, Apple owners tend to keep using those services. They don't even look outside of those because the world.
iMessage is huge. That's like one of the top reasons people don't switch to Android from iOS, because everyone's on iMessage.
Right.
Right, and they're already getting into cars with, I forget what it's called, but they have
Apple
something.
Car, yeah, or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Something like Sync.
Yeah,
that,
CarPlay. CarPlay, that's it.
Right, that makes your car into an iDevice.
Yeah. So there was a rumor, I don't know how true this is, Apple's denied it, from Digital Music News, that Apple, within 2 years, sooner or then later, will stop selling music for download. They're going to move towards a streaming-only service. Apple's issued a denial. But, of course, they would, wouldn't they? I mean, that's the last thing you want people to do, is start buying their music somewhere else, because Apple's going to shut down their music service. If Steve Jobs were alive, one source said, he would have killed it by now. Maybe.
Yeah.
Steve was always willing to make the next move boldly.
There's one reason people still need physical, digital movie or music, any digital files, but music in particular. With, we're all in this realm of everyone's a creator, everyone's got their YouTube channel and is getting their subs up as much as possible. Or people are out there creating digital media every day, and if you don't have an actual music track to lay over what you're doing, you can't do that with whatever you're streaming from Spotify, then you're not as creative as you could be. So people at least have to keep buying music for that reason.
This article cites a number of reasons why this might make sense. According to one analyst, once Apple Music hits 20 million subscribers, their revenues through streaming music will exceed the revenues through sales. And that should happen by, say, 2020, in the next few years. He says by 2020, Apple's download business would be 10 times smaller than the streaming revenue. And even more crucially, streaming revenue will have reached the 2012 iTunes Store download revenue peak. So the lines cross. That's the point at which Apple would choose to turn off the iTunes Store. Also, product confusion. I think part of the reason that we saw those articles about Apple deleted my music is this kind of confusion between downloading songs and owning them and having them on your hard drive and streaming them only. If you just are on a streaming service, those things don't, that doesn't come up. And also, I think you got to consider the music industry, which embraced Apple's iTunes initially because Apple was small. They didn't think that would be a big deal, whatever. Now, iTunes is the number one place people buy music, and that gives Apple a huge amount of power and influence in the music industry, and I don't think the music industry much likes that.
At the same time, the music industry would love to create a world where we own absolutely nothing.
Right.
And so streaming services, my only surprise is that they didn't create their own first. Well, again, we're talking about an industry that thinks backwards 20 years, not ahead.
That's a missed opportunity, isn't it?
Well, it's a good thing for you and me that they blew it, because I know for one thing, I'm not going to stop making backups of my music.
Right. We'll continue to own music, but
but you don't own it. That's the thing. You don't.
Right.
Even if you buy a CD, you don't own the music. You own the disc, but not literally. You don't own the.
Remember, though, how much artists hate this idea of streaming, because they say we don't get much money for streaming.
Yeah, but that's because the record industry is screwing them again, as it does whenever it has a chance.
Right. Yeah, and it would certainly solve the piracy issue. It would solve, if they could just get the revenues up to a certain point on streaming, I think the industry certainly would like it. I think one of the main reasons today people buy music is they want to reward an artist. You buy Taylor Swift's newest album or Beyonce's newest album, not because you have to. You can listen to it on streaming. You buy it because you want to give her $10. Thank you. It's a tip almost.
I mean, I'd like to see the artists control streaming because the streaming companies have not exactly been terrific for the artists either.
Right.
And it would be great if they could do this themselves. But, meet the new boss, same as the old one.
Right. And people still, too, travel to places where either they're not allowed to access their streaming content because they're no longer in their own country, or the internet access is just sketchy and they need to have things local.
Right. That's going to change too, though, right? That's eventually everybody will have everything everywhere, right?
You really think so?
I don't know.
Yeah, you're dealing with companies that
that's what Mark Zuckerberg wants and Google wants. And
It's not what Netflix wants, apparently. They've been blocking VPNs even. Right. So I use a VPN on Wi-Fi at home just to be safer. And as a result, Netflix won't let me watch on my devices at home.
That's Netflix more responding to the commercial interests of the motion picture industry than it is their own commercial interests.
Yeah, that's what they say. But they also claimed that when people got upset about it, they said, yeah, but we're releasing all of our stuff worldwide. And then it turned out I couldn't watch House of Cards either. So not so much. Netflix is becoming a lot like the studios that it has wanted to disrupt.
Right. Interesting. You all end up that way eventually. All right, we're going to take a break. Got a great panel. Dan Gilmore is here from the Cronkite School at Arizona State. He also writes a column, regular column in Slate. And it's always great to talk to one of the senior members of the tech journalist community. Doesn't mean you're old, just senior. You're like your top.
Yeah, I got
top
that.
Top dog.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thanks a lot.
And one of the young Turks, Stephen Kovac. Steve Kovac from techinsider.io. And, of course, our great friend and host of This Week in Law, Denise Howell Twill. And we have more to talk about. We haven't talked about Microsoft in ages. Let's find a Windows story. Throw one in. And Yahoo's for sale. And you won't believe who's considering to buy it. There's a tease. And Yahoo is up for sale, and you won't believe who bought it. Coming up. Did you see all the shows? You didn't see all the shows this week, because we had some really good stuff. But we've made a little mini movie so that you can be caught up. Here, take a look.
Previously on Twit.
But you bought a $340 mug?
Don't ask me why. I got a little carried away.
I did order a unicorn that farts rainbows when...
I'm sorry.
Triangulation. You may remember Dan Lyons, fake Steve Jobs, the secret diary of Steve Jobs.
After he died, I had this idea that he's blogging from the afterlife.
Oh.
Like he's still there.
Oh, wow.
And he's pissed at Tim Cook for screwing everything up. No, not the watch. Not the watch. No, don't do the watch.
Cook!
The new screensavers.
We're excited because the main cabinet's been here. How long have you been working on this main cabinet?
It's closing in on a year at this point. A woodworker fan of the network, Diami Palatki from the East Coast, reached out to me shortly after, and he was like, hey, I work with wood, and I'd be happy to work with you on this project.
Jason, you get to keep this.
It's kind of crazy. It's one of those I'm not worthy moments.
I can tell you this, Diami, every quarter that goes in here is going to go right back to you.
I'll put a little cup under there. It'll catch all the quarters.
Twit. Or if you're on a Commodore 64, it's Twit, 8, 1.
Well, I'm glad to know that. A great big week ahead. Is it Megan who has the week ahead for us? Megan, take it away.
Thanks, Leo. This week is Google I.O., the company's big developer conference where we get to hear about all the interesting things that are in the works from the company that brings you everything from mobile systems to machine intelligence. Remember last year when they showed off smart pants? Where are my smart pants now, Google? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen them. And speaking of Google, Nest is officially disabling the Revolve home automation service this week on May 15th. Now, we've been reporting on this since the announcement a few months ago, but next week, your Revolve home hub hardware will officially become a doorstop. Use it wisely. Next week, we'll also see earnings from Cisco and Salesforce. Facebook's trending stories controversy is unlikely to die down next week. And probably we will also hear more on the developing story of Apple's investment in a Chinese ride-hailing service. Jason Howell will be in the trenches at Google I.O. for most of next week, but I will be here reporting on all of this news and so much more on Tech News Today. I hope you'll be there with us. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Megan. Megan Maroney and Jason Howell on Tech News Today, Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. You got to watch each and every episode. Our show this week brought to you by Harry's. You may have noticed how clean-shaven and soft my cheek is. That's because I use Harry's high-quality, high-performance blades made in Germany. Because you know what? Harry's bought the factory. They decided if we're going to get people great blades at a great price, we got to own the place where they're made. They asked and they said the best razor blades are made at this factory in Germany. They bought them and now they ship them right to you, so the blades are half the price of leading brands. You don't have to deal with lines at the drugstore. Kind of feel like a criminal as you stand there as somebody comes to unlock the plexiglass so you can get your blades. That's a sign they're charging too much for the blades, I think. 1 million guys have made the switch to Harry's, including me. I love my Harry's. Easy to go to the website. Start with a Harry's kit like the Winston set. That's the one I use. I actually have a collection of Winstons. I've got the copper handle, the silver handle. I love my Winston's. And then, of course, I get the blades in the mail every month. And now you have your choice of foaming shave gel or the shave cream. I like the cream. It comes in a tube, but I know a lot of people like gels. You get your choice, and that's mailed to you each and every week. But you got to start with the razor handle, and that's where the kit comes in. Take a look at the Truman set. $15. You get a handle. You get three blades. You get a full-size, not a sampler, a full-size bottle of the gel or the cream. And the travel cover, which I think is actually really a very handy little added product. And then you get the razor and the shaving cream delivered to your door. So why pay $32 for an 8-pack of shaving blades when you get them for half the price from Harrys.com and a great shave? They've got the Truman set, as I mentioned, $15, but we've got a little deal for you. $5 off your first purchase when you go to harrys.com/twit, harrys.com/twit. Pick up the Truman kit. That's $10 and a great way to try it, get started. I think you'll like it. Harry's, stop compromising. Give Harry's a try today. harrys.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. So thank you, FCC. They're going to allow Charter Communications to merge with Time Warner Cable, a $78 billion merger. This after Charter already, got in trouble for flouting customer service rules. That didn't stop them. Remember, Charter was blocking cable subscribers from using their own modems, even though they weren't allowed to do so by law. Charter customers, in June 2012, the company stopped allowing new customers or those switching new price plans to use their own cable modems because they get $10 a month for renting them. This continued through August 2014, and the FCC slapped them with a fine that probably didn't come to 10% of the amount of money they made, a $640,000 penalty. And, oh, here's the prize. Why don't you merge with Time Warner? The big get bigger. It's $640,000 is 18 minutes worth of revenue for the combined companies. Time Warner Charter will make $18.6 billion a year.
That now there's still number two to Comcast, I think. So you got Comcast and this new Time Warner Charter. Don't know what to
are
say.
Are they number two in most hated companies?
Yeah, everybody hates their cable company, right? Well, and I've been getting a lot of calls. I do the the computer radio show, and it's heard in Los Angeles. And I've been getting calls from people who are furious because Verizon sold their Fios installation in that area and other areas of the country to a company called Frontier. Did you get sold, Denise, to Frontier?
Yes, we had Verizon service and just got a bill that all of a sudden said Frontier.
And Frontier's service has been execrable. Have you noticed any changes?
Only that they forgot to bill us for a month. So
that's
all
not
of a sudden
bad.
We
that's good.
Well, no, they wanted us to pay. They just forgot to send the bill during the whole transition. So whoops, now all of a sudden we're a month behind.
Oh.
But other than no, I haven't noticed a service issue.
Here's Channel 4's report from Long Beach as customers voiced their frustration.
TV and internet service last month.
The service has been up and down.
Frontier executive about the problems we've been covering for weeks. NBC4's Jane Yamamoto joins us live.
Frontier's apologized. Now a member of the California State Assembly representing Southern California has launched an investigation. So the alternative, what's the alternative for you guys? Time Warner! So I've been telling listeners, well, you got a choice. You can stay with Verizon / now Frontier and have terrible service. Or good news, you can go to Time Warner, which is about to be sold to Charter.
At least they have two high-speed things to choose from.
You have choice.
Unlike most of us.
Well, don't have that. Yeah, I have Time Warner and that's it.
Oh, man, really?
Yeah, that's my only choice.
And this is why, at least when it comes to the internet, the United States, where the internet was invented, is basically, number 20th on the list for the most, for speed and price. Our internet is not good. 584 complaints lodged with the Public Utilities Commission against Frontier. So you haven't had up and down service yet, Denise.
Not that I've noticed.
Don't worry.
But then again, our reliance on cable services, I haven't had up and down internet service.
Okay.
Our reliance on cable services is tailing off.
Right.
Month after month. I got rid of a bunch of our cable boxes recently. No one in the house noticed, except my son, who just asked me, where's my clock?
Perfect.
Yeah, I use it for a clock too.
That was it.
Oh man, that's a telling question.
Why are you still paying for it?
Good question.
Now look, her internet's starting to go down, by the way. I just want to point out, as soon as we start talking about Frontier, you're getting all scratchy.
Yes. For all the sports, live sports,
sure,
that my husband likes to watch.
That's the only reason.
Yep.
The Academy Awards, any of those live things. And I think it's not, we're not long for this world. We just made our new Twit t-shirt, by the way, the Teespring t-shirt. And we decided to celebrate the fact that we are IPTV, that we have for a long time, for 10 years now, really been a television network on the internet. What is the teespring.com/twit? Is that the?
Yeah.
This is we call it our World Tour T. It says Twit IPTV. And on the back, the reason we call it the World Tour TV is because we got all the t-shirt is because we got all the shows, but it looks like the concert dates. So this just went on sale. As with all of our t-shirts, it's only on sale for 30 days. And I talked Lisa into $20. She said, let's charge $25. I said, let's charge $19. She said, all right, I'm not going to go for the 19. We'll do 20. I said, okay, deal. So very affordable. 20, we have them in a variety of sizes, including, yes, we have women's, V-neck and regular, and there's also unisex for people who aren't sure which they are. And we only need 18 more to print, and we're going to get to that level, but we'll keep printing them for 28 days, and they will be shipped on June 12th. And there is a discount. If the more you buy, the less shipping costs, and I think that the price of the shirt goes down $5 too. So I thought I'd plug that. We are IP. We finally admit it. We've been IPTV all this time, and you didn't even know it. All you need is internet. Google I.O. around the corner. It's going to be Wednesday. What are we looking for? Anything exciting?
I'm the most excited about this Chirp thing.
Chirp is a really interesting.
Yeah, if they put Google Now in a can, that's going to be tough for me to not buy it. But at the same time, we have a history of things launching at I.O. that never really come to fruition. So I'm a little skeptical. But
what is the evidence for Chirp? Is it just a rumor or is it?
No, the information, I think, was the first publication that broke that they're working on an Amazon Echo-like device. And then I think it was Recode this week figured out that's the name Chirp, or at least it's the code name is Chirp. But you can easily imagine what it's going to be like. Basically, Google Now and a speaker. Hopefully it has a lot of good partnerships. I mean, the one reason I didn't buy Alexa right away was because it didn't have Spotify. So hopefully they have a lot of those.
It has Spotify now, though, by the way.
It does now, yeah. So hopefully, you know, they have a lot of those key partnerships locked down right away, Uber and all that kind of stuff that makes the Alexa Echo so much fun. But for me, I'm super excited to see what this thing's like.
I am a Echo fanatic. I have a Dot, the newest one, and I have several Echoes. I have one here in the office. I have them all over the house. And I love them because, the speakers aren't great, which is why I don't listen to a lot of music on the Echo. But now with the Dot, I have it paired to a good speaker system. So it's great. I can get great music. I use it for a timer.
Yeah. I used to use it that way, too. Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah. I think the Echo is a really interesting product, and I was always surprised that neither Apple nor Amazon had, Google had a similar product, so it makes sense. On the other hand, people might be a little nervous about it after reading Gizmodo's story, and it's not really confirmed that the FBI, they did a Freedom of Information Act with the FBI asking if they'd ever turned on the Amazon Echo for wiretapping purposes. And they got back a response from the FBI, we can neither confirm it nor deny it. So that isn't a confirmation, folks. It's just we can't confirm it or deny it.
Sounds like a threat.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought is. They would like you to think they could, even if they had, or maybe they hadn't thought of it. But really, aren't we surrounded by microphones the FBI could turn on with a court order?
Yes.
I mean, everywhere. Your TV, your Xbox, your phone, your webcam. James Comey, the director of the FBI, says, even admitted, I keep a piece of tape over my webcam. He knows.
It would be nice if they actually got court orders.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Just ask the court. The problem is the court, if it's the FISA court, never says no. Literally. They haven't said no to any request from law enforcement in 2 years. Zero. So I don't know if a court
order. I have a theory that actually there's really no FISA court. It's just a rubber stamp.
Joey.
It's a robot rubber stamp.
Yeah. He's in the basement of the Department of the Justice building. And what do you want? Oh, yeah, no problem. Approved. Okay, so Chirp, there's a good one. I agree with you. I think if Google were going to do an Echo competitor, what could they do better than Amazon does?
Well, I think what's great about Google Now is how it ties into everything that, you know, basically it hits your email. So
they know
flight
more.
Alerts. Yeah, right. They know more. Flight right. alerts, restaurant reservations from OpenTable, things like that are just going to be baked into there. So, you know, getting a reminder, hey, Google or whatever the keyword will be, when is my flight delayed? I think that'll be really cool. I just feel like they can open up so many more use cases just by the nature of how awesome Google Now is on the phone.
Yeah. I think one thing that Amazon does right with the Echo is it's somewhat of an open ecosystem. It is not hard to write they call them skills for the Echo. Amazon has a platform, you know, an Amazon Web Services platform that you can use to host the skills. And they don't charge a lot. It's very affordable. In fact, it's free for the first, you know. I mean, if you're just using it for personal use, it would be free. So use Amazon Web Services Lambda. So your code runs on Lambda in the cloud. You don't have to run a server or anything. And it's a fairly straightforward process to write skills. A lot of people are writing skills who are not particularly wizard coders. And you don't have to handle the language recognition. That's all handled for you. So Google, and I don't know if Google would do something this open. I'd love to see them do it. The problem with this is if you have an Echo,
it's a pain to figure out. There's like 80 pages of skills, and you have to enable the skills. So you have to figure out what the skills are, and then you have to remember the unique syntax. On the other hand, I love it that you could do this. So there you can have somebody, I could say, read Hacker News to you. You have to say, echo, open Hacker News, and then it will read to you. I play Jeopardy because the folks at Jeopardy have written a Jeopardy game, and they ask you six questions from last night's Jeopardy show. There's a lot of neat stuff. 90 pages now of skills. It's hard to keep track of.
But so you have to affirmatively turn those on?
Yeah, you have to go into your Alexa app. Don't you have an Alexa? I mean, an Echo?
I do, but I've never turned on
there
anything
you go.
Besides
the
what
problem.
Comes with the thing.
There's the problem right there. Now, I can tell you, your son is going to like a few of these. There's Alexa, give me a fart. very handy. There's, yeah, see what I'm saying? Your son's going to love this.
Yes.
There's, you can have it tell you a dad joke. The jokes are bad anyway, but it has even worse jokes for dad jokes. You can also ask it to tell, that's the syntax. Echo, ask for a fart.
Ask for a fart.
Well, yeah. Here's what
but
Google
you have to enable
do
that.
Right. Why should you have to enable it?
It
Why
just
shouldn't
know.
Alexa know that I want to fart when I ask
right,
for a fart?
Right. I mean, how hard can that be? And by the way, they sell it as all the fun of a fart without any of the smell. Just what we're looking for. They actually have some good skills. You can call an Uber, but you have to enable it. You can order a pizza from Domino's, I think, only Domino's. I'd like to see my local pizza joint. What else could you do? You can...
I ordered some plugs for some lights that I can turn on and off.
You know what? That's actually the simple, most useful... the single most useful thing is buying. Anything you've ever bought as an Amazon Prime user, you can tell Echo, buy me some more of that. And you have to enter a PIN code so that your kid can't do it. But, of course, your kid will be listening the next time you use it, so it's not really that effective. And it will send it to you. It arrives 2 days later. But you're saying you bought switches so you can turn on lights, right? Is that what you're saying, Jason?
Yeah, I bought switches. Yeah. I didn't buy them through it. I bought them on the website.
You could have.
But that I'll be able to say, you know, insert voice here, name here, turn on the living room lights, and the living room lights will turn on.
Echo, ask for a fart. Let's just see if it knows.
Oh, my God.
It's you know, suitable for children.
Thank you, Jeff Bezos.
I don't see Google doing that.
Parsi McParsface wouldn't do that?
Parsi McParsface ought to know that, how to do that. No, I think this is a great product, and I think Google should be better because they have all that voice recognition. They know everything. I can make appointments in here. I could tell the Echo to make an appointment for me on my Google Calendar, but I presume Google would do that even better. I've been meaning to write an Alexa skill. I'd like to do that.
I want to hook a Dot into my car with Wi-Fi.
A lot of people want to I was talking to somebody who I think has done that, one of our guests on Triangulation. Because, okay, so the Dot is like just the top part of the Echo. You cut off the speaker, and you can pair it to any Bluetooth speaker. So you'd pair it to your car.
Or aux plug it in, too.
The problem is that you'd need a battery backup on the Echo because it has to restart every time you turn on the car.
Yeah.
It would have to get – you'd have to use a Wi-Fi. You'd have to use one of those Mi-Fi so that it could have
– I mean, it's a huge setup. It's a lot of work. I wonder if it would be worth it, though.
I just ordered something from Logitech that they just announced that kind of does the same thing. It's a little magnetic dot that you put in your see if I can find it. You put in your vent, and then it's called Zero Touch. I think it's Alexa for the Echo for the car. Well, let me go back. It disappeared. There it is. Learn more. I got to click the Learn More button. So the idea is it's a smart car phone holder with a voice command app. So when the phone is on the holder, I guess it's magnetic, it launches the app. And then you can text by voice, voice-activated music, voice navigation. It can use Glimpse to share your location, hands-free calling. So even though your phone probably does that, this kind of integrates. It seems – anyway, I ordered it. I'll let you know. I'll do a review.
Sounds cool.
It's just a matter of time before we can just talk to everything around us, right? And it'll respond and do stuff.
I like that. Do you mind? Is that scary? Are you worried about surveillance?
It's also a matter of time before everything can listen to us, and people we don't want listening are going to be listening. And not talking about law enforcement necessarily, but the one thing we've seen in this Internet of Things world is that it's using the word security with Internet of Things is like a total oxymoron.
Good point.
They have consistently made security not even an afterthought. It's that bad.
Yeah.
I'm not even close to ready to doing this stuff for some time.
It is really a portal, an open door into your network in many cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, instead of doing it right, they've done the expedient thing. Gee, where does that happen before?
Yeah. Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah. Somebody says that I want to hear Denise's opinion on voice and what can or can't be done.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, along the lines of what Dan was saying, we're definitely going to see lawmakers start to pay attention to all this and insist that these devices in our homes have both security and privacy policies that are clear and reasonable and let people know, you know, if the device is going to be listening to everything that's going on in your home. That has to be clearly laid out, and you have to have people understand that that's the trade-off.
I have to say, though, I've always been, you know, my wife called me a bleeding heart liberal, and in favor of government regulation, this kind of stuff. But as time goes by, I'm getting more and more feared of government intrusion in this stuff. It doesn't feel like government regulation is a very good solution to a lot of this stuff. And you can not just point to here, but the EU as well, and some of the things the EU has been doing lately, where every time I go to a website now, I get a pop-up saying, oh, we use cookies. Is that okay with you? That's because of an EU regulation, and every website, if it wants to have, you know, do anything in the EU, has to do this, and it's dopey because all you do is you click yes, and then it's just like, why do I have to? It's meaning it doesn't do anything. It accomplishes nothing. And it wastes my time, and it wastes programmers' time, and it's a very good example of why government regulation is not always a good idea.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a good solution to the cookies problem. I don't get the feeling that there are going to be a lot of people who go out and research and go, what are these cookie things? And do I like them? And what flavors do they come in? Yeah, I don't
it's just,
see that.
It's just, you know, and it's every, it, and because, of course, the internet is global, it's got every site you go to now has to do this, even if they're not particularly a European site. So here it is. I just went to Real Madrid, all right, because we have some visitors from Spain, and there it is at the bottom. We use our own cookies and third-party cookies to measure traffic to our website and analyze browsers' behavior, blah, 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 blah. If you continue browsing, we consider that you accept the use of cookies, view our cookies policy. Yes, I accept. Yeah. That is on every freaking page you go to.
Yeah, but here's the problem with that language. That's nothing language.
Right.
If it said instead the other part of that, which is, we use cookies and other tracking technologies to spy on everything you do and track you around the World Wide Web and see, and we and a whole slew of shadowy advertising companies that you will never hear about are watching everything you do. Click here. I think people might be a little less happy about clicking.
Yeah, but not
call me crazy.
So do you use the internet, Dan?
I do, and I use blockers that basically stop the tracking stuff as to the extent possible.
It is a good point. There's nowhere on this banner where I could push a button that says, well, I would prefer you don't. All you can do is say yes. It's just, it's one of those, it's like a Prop 65 in California. It has exactly the opposite effect of the intended effect. The Proposition 65 said people have to warn you if there's carcinogenic chemicals in an area. So you just, everywhere you go in California, there's a Prop 65 warning that chemicals known to cause cancer are in this area. And you just ignore it now because it's everywhere. It's exactly the opposite of what the intent was. That's why I fear that government regulation is not the solution in a lot of these things. I don't know what the solution is, but I just...
Well, I mean, you might need government regulation to come in and say, okay, your disclosure about the cookies is really, really not cutting the mustard, not to mix cookies with mustard. But you have to be clearer about what's going on
here. Yeah, well, smart government regulation would be great.
Yes. Right.
That's maybe where I despair.
It wouldn't be hard.
I get concerned that we're headed for a world where you have people savvy enough to use Privacy Badger or whatever other blocker you're using, and the vast majority of people don't, and you have this tier of people who are getting targeted and spied on, and you know, the economic engine of everything that's relying on, and then there's this other class that is just opted out or paid out or however you're doing it.
Although, as CR1 points out, I have seatbelts and airbags in my car. Thank you, to the federal government for enforcing those rules, because otherwise I'd be flying through the windshield. And on the other hand, I don't think there's anything wrong with cookies. In fact, a lot of the web uses cookies. Windows 10 now on 300 million active devices, says Microsoft. That's still only a fraction of all the Windows-using devices, like a fifth. But that seems pretty good, partly because Microsoft's been giving it away, sometimes forcing you to take it. But they say that's going to end on July 29th. We are going to start making people pay.
Did the pop-ups go away in Windows 7 too?
Not yet.
After July 29th?
After July 29th, the pop-ups go away.
Oh, that's
cool. They should have just said that. We're sorry we've been bothering you for the last year, but good news. The pop-ups will be going away July 29th. We've spent some time talking on Windows Weekly about whether they really will start charging for it. I don't know if they should bother. Why bother charging for it? It's, you know, the Microsoft's future is not selling copies of Windows.
Well, it'll be great if they also stop downloading gigabytes of stuff to your computer without asking. That would be nice.
Right. Let's see. Lady emojis. I have to ask Denise, do you feel that emojis have misrepresented the fairer sex? Do we need better lady emojis? Stephen Colbert says we do.
Well, it's kind of getting back to that question. Are we watching Steven? Yes.
Yes, we are.
They express exactly how I feel, whether I'm feeling happy or sad or flag of Norway. All of my feelings.
And here's the thing. Use that one all the time.
Everyone likes emojis, but not everyone is properly represented in emojis. For instance, women are not well represented in the emoji world. But I just read that Google has announced that it's going to start producing new emojis that will represent professional women, such as scientists, doctors, educators, and farmers. The farmer emoji, of course, fertilizes her field with the emoji.
Yeah.
And I'm glad emojis are becoming more inclusive. It was only recently they added skin color options to represent people who don't have jaundice. Apparently, even though women use emojis more than men, they're a little underrepresented in the emojiverse. Let me show you how uneven it is. If you're a man in the world of emoji, you can be a police officer, a British palace guard, a Santa with a weird flesh beard, a private investigator, a bike helmet salesperson, a swami, a construction worker who also sells pot, and the saxophone player for Stay Human.
All right. That's enough of that. Do you feel underrepresented? I didn't even know this was an issue, and I feel terrible about it.
I've often felt not underrepresented as a woman, but just that emojis can't begin to get across everything that you need to in your communication needs.
I think that's finally, we're finally fixing emojis. Everybody's moved to stickers and GIFs.
It's, you know, I think part of the fun of emojis is it is a closed world and you have to be creative in how you put them together to convey what you're saying, but I, you know, all to the good. There's no, there's no central, it's not a government thing. You can't get mad at whoever's putting out emojis because
it's the Unicode Consortium, you know. Believe it or not.
Right.
Because okay. They decide, because it's part of the Unicode set. This is a request for comments. Expanding emoji professions, reducing gender inequality. And they have to get it approved by the folks at the Unicode Consortium. They're the ones who decide what's in the Unicode code set and what emojis are available.
So I don't know. I mean, if they have various emojis that could be either male or female, it would be nice if you had the choice, like you have the choice with skin color.
That would be nice.
Am I a boy swami or a girl swami?
That's a good point. And I don't think that would need approval because that's all the same Unicode symbol. There was a Kickstarter to raise money for the dumpling emoji. you have to actually buy a seat on the Unicode Consortium, and that's who decides emojis. And I don't see a lot of women or swamis on the. Here's a guy wearing a T-shirt that says "Shadowy Emoji Overlord." This is an actual meeting.
I want that shirt so badly.
These are the people who decide who's in charge. This is who's in charge. They decide what emojis will be in use. Wow. So the dumpling emoji is another movement, because dumplings are also, it turns out, underrepresented. We just got hot dogs and pizza.
I wish that someone would do a browser plugin for Chrome and Firefox that if on the desktop I hover the mouse over it, it translates it.
Oh, and so you know what it means.
I don't always, in fact, I don't often know what it means. And something that would translate on mobile, too, I would be very grateful. So please, somebody out there, please do that.
Well, you know about Emojipedia. This is where you go if you want to know what an emoji means. You paste it into Emojipedia, and it gives you everything you'd ever want to know. It even shows you the representations of the emojis for all the different phones and Google and Microsoft and Twitter and Facebook. Because, you know, they have a... See, that Mozilla one, that blowing a kiss, that's definitely a lady emoji right there. It's a weird one. I don't know what's going on with the eyes. Oh, I guess she's winking. I get it. Yeah. Microsoft's blowing a kiss also. A lady emoji. Let's take a break, and we could talk about what's going to happen to Yahoo. Apparently, Warren Buffett is now getting into the act, and he's got friends. Our show today brought to you by this little doohickey. This is a great thing. This is the tracker. And, you know, I was just looking because I didn't have my keys with me. I thought, where are my keys? So I launched the tracker app on my smartphone, and it tells me where my keys are, which is pretty darn awesome. But there's even more you can do with the tracker. See, there's where my keys are. And it says, last seen 2:16 p.m. on Sunday, May 15th. Oh, that's at home. I left them at home. But I just found out I can do other things with the tracker. For instance, this is Jason's tracker. See, it's so cute. It's about the size of a quarter. And so it will let me know when I get separated from his phone. But it also, if I'm carrying around the tracker and I've left a phone under a cushion, I can press the button on the tracker. And the phone lets me know where it is. Isn't that awesome? By the way, you can pick your own sound. That's an excellent choice. And if you're driving in the car, no, you are not being stopped right now. That's just Jason's tracker. I hate it when they do that on radio shows. The tracker, these are the new trackers. They're really nice, coin-sized, aluminum. You can put them on anything. And this is the neat thing. Tracker is the largest network of trackers, and this is the Crowd GPS network. Now, obviously, something this small and light and inexpensive doesn't have a GPS in it. The phone has the GPS, so it uses that. But here's the cool thing. If your phone gets near somebody else's tracker, it notices it and sends a note to their tracker. So if your item goes missing, the tracker app records the last known location on a map, and then when another tracker user comes within 100 feet of it, you're going to get an update of where your item is. So other people will help you find your tracker. It's got 1.5 million trackers out there right now. That's pretty guaranteed. Tracker just announced their Tracker Atlas. It works with your Tracker Bravo. That's what this is. Or your third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items inside the house. What? Yep. So now you don't just know it's, well, the keys are at home. You know they're under the cushions. You just ask the Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you get an answer. You don't even need to search. I love these things. Tracker Bravo. It's beautiful. Anodized aluminum. It's thin. It's light. And when you go to thetracker.com, you're going to get 30% off your entire order. They've got nice colors. Works with the iPhone, the Android phone. Go to thetracker.com and use the promo code TWIT. 30% off your trackers. Attach them to everything. Remote controls. What would you... You could put it on a dog. It's light enough for a collar. What would you attach your tracker to? I have it on my back. What I do is I put them on my keys, and then I put my keys in the backpack, so it's kind of, keeping an eye on both. Really cool idea. THETRACKR. No E at the end there. .com. And use the promo code TWIT for 30% off. So you may remember the names Tim Cadigan and Dan Rosenzweig. They were Yahoo executives, no longer there, but they have formed a consortium, including Warren Buffett and Bain Capital. Is it Bain? No. Who's involved with this? Quicken Loans founder and Cleveland Cavaliers owner Dan Gilbert to make a bid on Yahoo. So we've heard that Verizon's making a bid, but by the way, it's moving along now. They're having day-long meetings with Marissa Meyer and the Yahoos and stuff. And these guys, Rosenzweig was COO at Yahoo from 2002 to 2006. Cadigan was in charge of search and advertising from 2003 to 2008. Presumably, they have some inside information that makes Yahoo more valuable than the rest of the folks think. Neither is interested in taking a larger managerial role there. They both have their own startups. What do you think? What's going to happen to Yahoo? Dan, can Yahoo be saved? If Marissa Meyer can't save it, who can?
Well, hard to say that she's done that good a job in trying. A lot of acquisitions for no apparent purpose. And
Tumblr.
And killing off some very good stuff. This Buffett thing is really interesting. Someone, I don't know if she's still on the Berkshire Hathaway board, but Hillary Schneider, who was a senior person at Yahoo, was on the Berkshire board of directors. And she's gone off to run some other company, but I can see some pieces possibly fitting together if that's why he's in it. But yeah, Yahoo can be saved. It's a they're still enormously used by lots of people, and I think that they're running out of time for sure. But there's a lot of cash flow there, and there's a lot of pretty amazing properties that they could still do a lot with. I think it's been to some degree squandered, but it's not over.
There's users for sure. This article's by Kara Swisher. She seems to know pretty well what's going on inside Yahoo before anybody else does. She says that the it's guessed that the company will go for $4 billion once you separate out about $1 billion in patents. So who's bidding? Verizon, some private equity firms, TPG, Sycamore Partners, Vista Equity, and Bain Capital. And now, Warren Buffett and Dan Gilbert. Kind of interesting. $4 billion? I don't know.
Seems like a lot of money for a company. I've been sitting here trying to think of how I've encountered Yahoo in the last year of my life. And I think the only two ways I can come up with is reprinting AP news stories and posting Flickr.
Flickr is the last gem there. It's not worth $4 billion, but it's definitely... still a gem. Although Flickr, you wonder, why didn't they launch an Instagram before Instagram? You know, why did they miss the boat on that stuff? If anybody could do it, they could. Let's see. Anything else we want to get in here? The Philly police have admitted now
That was great. That was their truck. So I'm glad Denise is here because I would love to know the legal ins and outs of this. So the Philadelphia police are employing a device. Let's see if I could find the name here, called the LSAG MPH-900. It is a automatic license plate reader, and it's a pretty damn sophisticated one. It uses infrared to look at temperature differentials on license plates between the raised letters and the base of the plate, and it can read multiple license plates at the same time with great accuracy. Who knew? More than 1,000 agencies across all 50 United States are using the digital automatic license plate reader. They're sitting on the roads and just capturing every license plate that goes by. You know, I know people complain about license plate, you know, red light cameras and the readers on bridge tolls and so forth. But apparently the police can just, you know, sit on the road and do it. But they're a little hesitant because, you know, these trucks, these vans have some equipment on the roof, and maybe that might scare people. So the Philadelphia police said, oh, we can fix that. And they affixed a Google Maps logo to the truck.
It's not even a good disguise.
It's a bad Google Maps logo.
They just took the app icon and made a little sticker and put it on the car. I mean, it's like a clown car. It's just hilarious that they thought that would do it.
Yeah, but you two are the only people in the world who – or not the only two, but you're among the very few people who would know the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I would look at that and go, I would even say, yeah, that's – sure, that's a strange sticker, but that must be them.
I mean
– Well, right, because Google owns those logos and trademarks. You really aren't allowed to use them without Google's permission. So that's just a no-no.
is it allowed? I guess the streets are public. It's allowed for can anybody have one of those devices and sit on the street and watch license plates go by?
I don't see why not. I mean, you're out in public.
It's public.
People can, yeah. They can
so not only law enforcement, but I can do it.
Probably.
Right. So, you know, that's interesting. However, they might be in trouble with Google because, as you say, it's their trademark. In fact, Google seems pretty unhappy about it.
there are a couple of companies now that are actually doing this routinely and selling the data to anybody who wants it.
If you have a billboard, you want to know who's going by.
Yeah. They're like arguing that. It's First Amendment gives them the right to do that.
Wow.
Denise, does that fly for you?
It's a First Amendment.
First Amendment, I don't get the speech component there or, you know, how government would be abridging your speech so that the First Amendment is invoked. But
I think a lot of people just think the First Amendment is the right to do anything you want.
Yeah, no, it's privacy. You know, I mean, what gets people's senses tingling is, hey, I didn't give you permission, and that's my private information. But when you're out in public, privacy to a large extent goes out the window. You can be photographed in public as long as you don't reasonably feel that you're in a photo-free zone. So, I just don't see why they can't do it.
I'm sure they can. But the difference now is, of course, that the stuff becomes ubiquitous. I don't think that people had any expectation that they would be trackable at everything they do, at every place they go.
And of course, the addition not only of the tracking devices, but the ability to create massive interrelated databases that can deduce all sorts of stuff from the state of smog that you leave behind you. Mm-hmm. That's the real power of it, right? It's not merely knowing that you were on the street. It's knowing everywhere you went, what you saw, and there you go.
Well, it's maybe pointing out the need for some other vehicle identification system that
At least we don't have to put our social security number on the back of our cars.
Right.
could be worse.
Well, that's so easy to get that what's the difference?
Yeah, really.
I mean, the whole point of a license plate is so that the public can identify you and turn you in if you're doing something wrong, and the police can identify you if you're at a stop or So they're, you know, here's
they're using it.
Somebody needs to entrepreneurially come up with an alternative to the license plate. Float it out there.
It also feels a little bit like a fishing expedition. Like they're just sitting there. But I guess that's what a police officer would do anyway. If he had a, you know, an APB on a license plate, he'd be looking at the license plate. So this just automates the process. Isn't there a long-standing tradition though of the police and FBI hiding their activities in a van that has like the local pest control?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, or is that just in movies? Because they're not allowed to use other people's trademarks? You can't say you're the phone company?
Well, there is some degree of government immunity from lawsuit, but this seems like a pretty egregious misrepresentation and taking of logos for a very unauthorized purpose.
I think he could just send a Philly cheesesteak to whoever's in charge over there, Larry Page, and call it a day. Here's a, you know, enjoy. Sorry, we didn't mean to do that.
Do the trick.
Sorry, Larry. Yeah. We didn't mean to do that. Well, we are looking forward to a Google I.O. It's coming up. Normal truck. Let's go elsewhere. That's it. That's how they should do it. Right. Hey, no. We have a Wi-Fi access point called FBI surveillance van here in the studio. Have we ever figured out whose that is? Jason, have you figured that out? Used your spidey sense? I think it might be Alex Gumpel. I don't know.
I think it's across the street.
You think it's across the street?
Yeah.
Is it that van?
In the van.
All right, we're going to wrap this up. Google I.O. is Wednesday. Our live coverage begins then. We expect some VR stuff, too. I wouldn't be surprised to see... I would be surprised to see any Android Wear information. I feel like Google says, yeah, we're bored with that. That's done. I would be surprised to see anything about Nest. They don't want to talk about that. It'll be all upbeat. VR. Maybe I would love to see, and maybe we got a lot of, you know, Google developers here. Bet you'd love to see this, too. The rumor that maybe the Chrome OS and Chromebooks will have an Android store in there, and you can put Android apps on your Chrome OS. I'd love to see that. Be good for you, right? Yeah. Be good for me. Want to thank you so much for joining us. It's great to see you again, Dan Gilmore. Anything you want to mention, the plug that you're up to?
Well, working on a new book, but that's so far away that too early to plug.
Permission taken.
But thanks for having
us. Is it about these privacy issues?
It's partly about that.
Good. I look forward to that. Definitely want to get you on when that comes out. And, of course, if you're lucky enough to be a student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at ASU, make sure you stop by and say hi and ask for Dan's class. Want to also thank you, Steve Kovac, from TechInsider.io. Always great to see you. What are you working on these days?
Same stuff. I mean, just sites going really well. Nothing to plug other than just visit Tech Insider and check us out. We're approaching our one-year anniversary, which is a big deal this summer. So I'm
did you guys get a redesign? I really like the look. It feels like a new look.
No, same design from day one. I mean, again, it's only been 9 months or 10 months.
You don't redesign a nine-month-old site.
No. But, yeah, it's a new look for company as a whole for our websites. BI doesn't look much like that, but we got that big splash at the top.
I love that splash. You
might see that look kind of bleed over to our other properties.
Please forgive me for using an ad blocker. I'm sure you have tasteful ads somewhat in there that I am not seeing. Very nice. And Miss Denise Howell, always a thrill. Thank you so much for stepping in at the last moment. We'd hoped to have Mike Elgin on, but his connection from Mexico is just not good enough.
So happy to be here. So happy I could jump on.
Greatest.
To see you. Great to see Dan, and great to meet Steve.
This weekend,
nice meeting you too.
Yeah, every Friday on the Twit Network. Make sure you tune in. You're around about 1 in the afternoon.
No, 11 o'clock.
11, that's right. It's Scott's that's on right after you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 11 a.m.
Twyatt's on right after us, unless you change the schedule.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Remember, it's my day off. I'm very foggy.
It's
I don't
your
know
day
what
off.
I'm listening to. Yes. I know I listen, though. I love it. Thank you, Denise. Really appreciate it. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We do Twit every afternoon, every Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200
UTC. If you'd like to stop by and watch live and be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, we would welcome you with open arms. We also love having a studio audience, and a great studio audience today, visiting from Spain and Mallorca and Uruguay and other places all around the globe. If you want to be here, just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put chairs out for you. We'll be glad to have you. You can also download copies of every show, audio and video, available at twit.tv and wherever you get your podcasts. So please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Thank you.
This is amazing.